Don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. What is up, crew? Welcome back to the show. I was actually planning on doing a guy's take episode again today, like I did earlier this week. But it looked like what I was working on, or it looks like what I've been working on all morning is going to take me a lot longer than I had originally thought. So I don't think I'm going to be able to get to it today. So I think I'm going to go ahead and dive into a piece that I knew I was going to get to. And this is going to be a little bit more in the weeds. It's specifically about Schnorr signatures, which we've done a number of those in the past. But this one is by Lucas Nuzzi, who we've just read a work by him very recently. I can't remember exactly what episode it is, and I didn't bother to look it up. But we just read his resolution of the big block experiment. So it was just earlier this week, I think, if I'm not mistaken. And that one was really good. And this one actually adds quite a bit of interesting thoughts and discussion, like some additional insights on Schnorr signatures than a few of the ones that we have read in the past. If you haven't covered the Schnorr signature article from Bitcoin Magazine, I think that one was written by Aaron Von Wertheim. That is another really good one to dive into. But I think this one really has enough unique about it. And since we are getting closer to Schnorr signatures and we have a proposal now, a specific BIP, I think it's just going to be really exciting, and it's fun to dive into this a little bit more deeply and see what, you know, other people's thoughts on it are, and talk about how all these things are going to come together when or if they get soft forked into Bitcoin. And I think Schnorr signatures is a huge, huge thing that is really important, and for a lot of the reasons that this article lays out. So without further ado, we are going to jump right into it. This one, again, is by Lucas Nuzzi. And if you didn't follow him on Twitter or Medium last time, this one should probably convince you, because he is definitely one to follow, and he is always producing. He has quite a bit of things to read and fun stuff to cover on Digital Asset Research is actually the name of the blog that he posts with. So without wasting any more time, let's go ahead and jump into his piece, Schnorr Signatures and the Inevitability of Privacy in Bitcoin. A thanks to Peter Wella for generously providing feedback on this article and educating me on Schnorr. Since his review, I've made lots of changes to simplify key concepts presented here. Any errors and opinions found herein are my own. Digital signatures are the backbone of online sovereignty. The advent of public key cryptography in 1976 paved the way for the creation of a global medium of communication, the internet, and an entirely new form of money, Bitcoin. While the fundamental properties of public key cryptography have not changed much since then, there are now dozens of open source digital signature schemes available in the cryptographer's toolbox. When Satoshi Nakamoto began to work on Bitcoin, one of the key design choices to be considered was which signature scheme to use in this open, permissionless financial system. The requirements were clear. Satoshi needed an algorithm that was widely used, well understood, sufficiently secure, lightweight, and most importantly, open source. Out of all options available at the time, he went with the one that fit that criteria the most, the Elliptic Curve Digital Signature Algorithm, or ECDSA. Back then, ECDSA was natively supported by OpenSSL, a set of open source encryption tools developed by cypherpunk veterans to improve the privacy of online communications. Relative to other popular schemes, ECDSA carried the benefits of leaner computational requirements and shorter key lengths, useful attributes for a digital form of money. At the same time, it also provided a proportionate level of security to schemes like RSA. A 256-bit ECDSA key, for example, has equivalent security to a 3072-bit RSA key, but it is a fraction of its size. The hard work of Peter Wella and others on an improved curve, as in elliptic curve, called SECP256K1, made Bitcoin's ECDSA faster and more efficient. However, there are still inherent deficiencies in ECDSA that justify replacing it all along. After a couple of years of research and experimentation, a new signature scheme is set to increase the privacy and efficiency of Bitcoin transactions, the Schnorr Digital Signature Scheme. In this article, I provide a general overview of the multiple implementations of Schnorr signatures and their corresponding benefits. Then I explore MuSig, a new multi-signature standard that serves as a building block for novel Bitcoin technologies like Taproot. Lastly, I describe how the fully realized version of Schnorr can break the heuristics used in blockchain analysis and at the same time help develop a strong fee market in Bitcoin's main layer. The rise of Schnorr signatures. Even though the Schnorr digital signature scheme carries many benefits over ECDSA, it is certainly not new. It was invented by Klaus Peter Schnorr, a German cryptographer and academic, while he was a professor and researcher at the University of Frankfurt in the 1980s. His proposed signature scheme was an amalgamation of the research and work of David Chaum, Tayer Algamal, Amos Fiat, and Adi Shamir. Nevertheless, before publishing it, Klaus Schnorr filed multiple patents for his newly invented scheme, which, for years, prevented its direct use. Interestingly enough, ECDSA's predecessor, DSA, was a hybrid of the Algamal and Schnorr schemes that was solely devised to circumvent Klaus Schnorr's patents. In fact, only 2 months after Schnorr's U.S. patent was issued, DSA's progenitor, the U.S. National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, also filed a patent for its workaround. And here's a bit of prime cypherpunk history. After that happened, Klaus Schnorr became very defensive of his patents and directly responded to his critics in the CoderPunks mailing list, an offshoot of the original CypherPunks mailing list. His responses can be read here and here. An internal NIST memo describing patent issues can also be found here. In 2008, nearly 2 decades after the introduction of the Schnorr signature scheme, Klaus Schnorr's patent expired. Coincidentally, 2008 was also the year our favorite cypherpunk, Satoshi Nakamoto, was implementing Bitcoin. Even though Schnorr signatures could have been used at the time, they were not standardized nor widely used, which was probably Satoshi's motivation to go with ECDSA instead. Although frequently described as atrocious by cryptographers and mathematicians alike, ECDSA was, and still is, widely used, and it provided a safer option for Bitcoin back then. Schnorr on Bitcoin. Fast forward another decade and Schnorr's scheme is much less esoteric today, with standardized implementations like ED25519 becoming a popular option for some altcoins. Informal talks about potentially implementing Schnorr on Bitcoin date back to this 2014 Bitcoin talk thread, but a proposal was only formalized after years of research and experimentation when Peter Wella wrote the Schnorr BIP. This draft BIP describes the specifications and technicalities of a potential Schnorr implementation, which would carry the following benefits over ECDSA. Security proof. The security of Schnorr signatures is easily provable when a sufficiently random hash function, random oracle model, is used, and the elliptic curve discrete logarithm problem, or ECDLP, used in the signature is sufficiently hard. Such a proof does not exist for ECDSA. Non-malleability. ECDSA signatures are inherently malleable, which may enable a third party without access to the private key to alter an existing valid signature and double spend funds. This issue was formally discussed in BIP 62. In comparison, Schnorr signatures are provably non-malleable. Linearity. Schnorr signatures have the remarkable property that multiple parties can collaborate to produce a signature that is valid for the sum of their public keys. This is the building block for various higher-level constructions that improve efficiency and privacy, such as multi-signatures and other smart contracts. The security proofs provided by Schnorr, as well as its non-malleability guarantees, offer clear benefits over ECDSA. A soft fork could be justified solely on the basis of these two benefits. However, it is Schnorr's linearity property that is particularly exciting. In essence, this enables multiple signers in a multi-signature or multi-sig transaction to combine their public keys into an aggregated key that represents the group, a property that has been called key aggregation. While the ability to fuse keys may sound trivial, the benefits of key aggregation should not be underestimated. Since multi-sigs are not natively supported by ECDSA, they had to be implemented in Bitcoin via a standardized smart contract. Yes, Bitcoin has smart contracts too, called pay-to-script hash, or P2SH. This enables users to add spend conditions called encumbrances to specify how funds can be spent. For example, only unlock balance if both Alice and Bob sign this message. The first problem with P2SH is that it requires knowledge of the public keys of all signers participating in the multisig, which is not an efficient system. Aggregating these keys would allow for more efficient validation, as only one key needs to be verified by the network rather than N keys. That also makes less footprint on the blockchain, lower transaction costs, and improved bandwidth. The second problem with P2SH is that it offers very little privacy guarantees. As specified by BIP 13, P2SH transactions require different addresses that begin with the number 3. This allows blockchain observers to not only identify all P2SH transactions in the network, but also pinpoint the identities within the multisig. And here we've just got a diagram of a multi-signature transaction with 3 signers, and don't really need to explain it. It's just basically showing for reference, as you'll see in the writing, that you can tell who is signing which parts of the transaction and that it is a multi-signature transaction simply by looking at it. In the example above, the network would be aware of 1. The existence of a multi-sig transaction, 2. How many signers it is comprised of, and 3. Who the signers are. Not good for operational security, especially for use cases like two-factor, and not good for privacy. Key aggregation, on the other hand, allows signers to remain anonymous and does not compromise operational security by revealing the keys required to unlock a balance. Most importantly, key aggregation makes it so that multi-sigs can become indistinguishable from regular transactions. And here we have the same graphic except with Schnorr signatures, showing that rather than signing with 3 separate identifiable public keys, it is signed with a single public key aggregated from the three participants and therefore indistinguishable from any other transaction. The first iteration of Schnorr in Bitcoin will retire the op-check-sig and op-check-multi-sig family of opcodes currently used with ECDSA in favor of a new class that has been called op-check-DLS. Without going into too much detail, DLS stands for Discrete Log Signature, and it allows signatures to be verified more efficiently with less opcodes. Back in early 2018, Gregory Maxwell, Andrew Poelstra, Yannick Surin, and Peter Wella published a white paper on a new Schnorr-based multi-signature scheme called MuSig. Since the publication of MuSig, they've been working hard to translate the proposed multi-sig scheme into usable code. Link. One of the most interesting things about MuSig in the context of key aggregation is the possibility for the creation of private smart contracts outside of the blockchain. In essence, MuSig enables multi-sig participants to attach encumbrances to the aggregated keys off-chain, which does not require Bitcoin's consensus rules to be aware of it. In December 2018, Anthony Towns was the first core developer to make a semi-formalized proposal for the activation of Schnorr, which was posted on the Bitcoin Dev mailing list. I expect more conversations about a potential soft fork to come up in the following months. To summarize, the first iteration of MuSig in Bitcoin will natively support key aggregation, which can immediately 1. Improve the privacy of multisigs, 2. Increase the efficiency of transaction validation, 3. Improve security by eliminating the inherent problems of ECDSA, and 4. Enable smart contract solutions like Taproot, which I plan to cover soon. And 4. Enable smart contract solutions like Taproot, which I plan to cover soon. But this is just the beginning. All right, this is a good place to stop. I am parched. I'm going to go get a drink. We will talk about our sponsor real fast, and we will jump right back into this. I hope you guys are enjoying this as much as I do. I am super nerdy, and I love all this stuff about key aggregation, and I think these are huge improvements coming to Bitcoin, and this is one of the things I've been most excited about for quite a while now. No more rambling. Let's go ahead and hit our sponsor, and I'll be right back. Cross-input aggregation, the next step for Bitcoin privacy. As covered in the last section, key aggregation is an incredibly useful feature for multisigs that spend a single input. Since Bitcoin transactions usually have more than one input, future iterations of Schnorr can also be leveraged to create an interactive aggregate signature scheme, IAS, where all inputs in a transaction are spent simultaneously with a single signature. Once again, the interactions between signers occur entirely off-chain, but now a single signature can be used to spend all inputs of a transaction. Each input would still have its own public key, but spendable by a Schnorr IAS. Greg Maxwell, Peter Wella, Anthony Towns, and others have been working on an evolution of the Taproot smart contract scheme to facilitate this functionality. They call this scheme Generalized Taproot, or GROOT, GROOT. It can make the transition from key aggregation to cross-input aggregation much easier in the future. Like key aggregation, cross-input aggregation further increases the efficiency of Bitcoin transactions, but most importantly, it may enable strong privacy-preserving mechanisms on Bitcoin's base layer. One of the most exciting aspects of cross-input aggregation is the way it can improve CoinJoin transactions in Bitcoin. For context, CoinJoin is a privacy-preserving technique where multiple senders and receivers are combined within a single transaction. The goal is to make it difficult for a blockchain observer to link specific senders and receivers, thereby enabling the entities within the CoinJoin to claim plausible deniability. This technique was originally proposed by Greg Maxwell on Bitcoin Talk in 2013 and has since been offered through various services, including JoinMarket, SharedCoin, ShufflePuff, DarkWallet, and CoinShuffle. Variations of CoinJoin, such as the Chalmian CoinJoin scheme used in the Wasabi wallet, greatly improved upon the original model. However, since anonymity loves company, it still relies on a sufficiently large number of users to obfuscate their balances as well. Another issue with CoinJoin today is the identifiability and potential censoring of the entire transaction type. Consider that the most used heuristic in blockchain analysis today is to follow specific inputs in order to determine if two or more addresses belong to the same entity. If Alice and Bob sent 1.982723 Bitcoin, for example, a blockchain observer could track the decimals of that specific input to map the transaction graph, or the historical breakdowns and changes of ownership of a UTXO. To prevent that, CoinJoin implementations require common value denominations, whereby everyone within the CoinJoin sends the same amount. Users of the Wasabi wallet, for example, send the same denomination of 0.1 BTC in CoinJoin transactions of 100 participants. Although it is still hard to pinpoint the connection between specific senders and receivers, the blockchain observer can look for common denominations to identify that a CoinJoin took place and advise its clients to censor all entities involved. Cross-input aggregation can help with that, as it introduces an additional obfuscation mechanism at the protocol level. In essence, cross-input aggregation can enable the construction of Schnorr-based CoinJoin transactions with N signers that look like regular single-signer transactions to outsiders. That may also enable CoinJoin to be more easily implemented in popular wallets without strenuous engineering, which may increase the network's overall anonymity set, or the number of users using this technique. The common denomination issue can further be resolved with additional techniques such as pay-to-endpoint, or P2EP, which combines Satoshi's early work on privacy, see P2IP, with CoinJoin, whereby both senders and receivers contribute inputs to a transaction. This novel technique deserves a standalone post, but you can read more about it here, here, and here. Links provided. P2EP is backwards compatible, and when used in conjunction with Schnorr, it may enable sufficient privacy in Bitcoin's base layer. Two birds, one stone. It is reasonable to assume that Bitcoin's mass adoption depends upon the strength of its privacy guarantees. At the same time, the popularity of the Lightning Network and its own potential to host private payments has also generated uncertainty about future demand for on-chain settlement after the last Bitcoin has been mined. As such, the need for privacy and the long-term sustainability of Bitcoin without block rewards are perhaps two of the most alarming issues surrounding Bitcoin today. Thankfully, the privacy mechanisms enabled by Schnorr can potentially address these two issues simultaneously. I've spent thousands of hours reviewing sophisticated privacy technologies, including different implementations of ring signatures, confidential transactions, bulletproofs, ZK snarks, Starks, and Mimblewimble. While some of these technologies are mature enough to be implemented on Bitcoin's base layer, they still carry unique risks and trade-offs. As you have probably heard, Bitcoin is a hard fork averse, which makes it difficult to envision a scenario where any of these technologies get implemented at all. A recurring concern that people seem to have with the use of homomorphic encryption or non-interactive zero-knowledge proof systems is that they prevent the full auditability of Bitcoin's monetary base. In other words, when transaction values are encoded, it becomes difficult to verify whether Bitcoin's supply cap is, in fact, 21 million Bitcoin. Similarly, inflation bugs and double spends become harder to pinpoint when transaction amounts are hidden. This is a considerable trade-off, and a push for the implementation of cutting-edge privacy on Bitcoin's base layer could divide the community. What if these technologies don't even need to be implemented in order for Bitcoin's base layer to gain sufficient privacy? Schnorr can definitely help with that. If most Bitcoin transactions were to use Schnorr's cross-input aggregation feature in conjunction with P2EP, it would become nearly impossible to de-obfuscate specific senders and receivers over time by simply looking at the blockchain. Bitcoin's supply would still be auditable, but its transactions would also provide much stronger privacy guarantees. If there is demand for privacy, it is also reasonable to assume that Bitcoin users and businesses may want to engage in CoinJoin transactions passively and let their wallets constantly mix their balances in the background. In this case, demand for privacy directly translates into an increase of on-chain transaction fees. Like SegWit, users will most likely champion the adoption of the technology at first, but businesses will have to follow suit at some point to remain relevant. In time, the adoption of these technologies will make blockchain analysis obsolete and effectively removed from the required AML-KYC procedures that Bitcoin businesses are subject to, just like physical cash. When you deposit cash to your bank account, the bank won't check the bills for traces of drugs and prevent your deposit if they find any. There is no reason why this is done with Bitcoin, other than the proliferation of blockchain analysis coupled with the shortcomings of techniques like CoinJoin without Schnorr. When performing AML-KYC on specific addresses and UTXOs becomes irrelevant, and the focus turns onto individuals rather than balances, Bitcoin businesses will fully embrace privacy. In fact, I suspect that when that happens, privacy and fungibility will become an integral part of the value proposition of future Bitcoin businesses. Ultimately, the adoption of stronger privacy mechanisms on Bitcoin's base layer will further empower its users and, at the same time, could contribute to the creation of a vibrant fee market after the last Bitcoin has been mined. My guess is that it all starts with Schnorr's activation, which everyone seems to be on board with. Schnorr signatures and the aggregation methods and Groot, the ability to do off-chain smart contracts that like you can add encumbrances to signatures that are not based in the Bitcoin consensus rules. So you essentially have a much higher degree of freedom in like how you construct them, and the ability. I've always kind of thought that this was the thing that was going to make and it may not happen like this, but I've always kind of had it in my mind that quote-unquote CoinJoin transactions, because they're aggregating signatures, because the 3 or 4 or 20 or 100 separate public keys end up being a single public key after it's being aggregated with just, you know, a random group of inputs. The fact that that is possible makes it, not only does it encourage a really strong fee market on the base Bitcoin layer, it also encourages the aggregation of keys. Because if you're splitting, since, you know, having one input or two inputs or five inputs with one signature is not as much space savings as having 100 inputs with one signature. Because think about it, like if you break it up into groups of five, let's say you transmit 20 signatures with five inputs apiece and one public key, one Schnorr signature. Well, if you did that as 100 inputs, you would eliminate 19 of those public keys in the broadcasting data to the blockchain. So not only does it create a vibrant fee market by not making a settlement to the base layer a privacy loss, or a risk in that way, it essentially gives it sufficient privacy and makes the things like I think I've mentioned before on the show, or I've posted on Twitter or something, the idea of a transaction compression service, where you, rather than strictly calling it a privacy improvement or calling it a mixer or something, you can literally just have it so if you're not really concerned with privacy, like if privacy isn't really your top concern, which for a lot of people it really isn't, you know, they don't think about the longer term consequences of either losing privacy, or they just don't feel like they have anything to hide. You know, if I buy something at Target, like, I don't care if somebody knows that I went to Target. So, you know, there are degrees of this, but you're still incentivized to use it because those, just aggregating the signatures is a savings cost. You can eliminate those, you know, 19 other public keys that would have to be posted as data to the blockchain, and whatever the resulting fee is for broadcasting that transaction can be, the savings can be split among everybody who's, you know, going together and being like, all right, let's, you know, aggregate these things so that we can save a little bit of money on fees. And it makes the fee market, it adds a degree of strength to the fee market because no individual is paying a huge fee. You know, if you're mixing with 100, 200 other people, a $50 fee is actually just 25 cent or 50 cent for a transaction. I mean, this has real serious, like, fundamental impacts to what's going on at the base layer. And to have one opcode replace basically a sequence of opcodes that came before it is also a huge, is it in itself a space savings. Because you have to list the opcodes. It's a stack. And it's just, this Schnorr signatures has always been, for quite some time, because it helps, it helps with Lightning. It makes opening up Lightning channels, so much easier. That's one thing that he didn't even talk about is, in addition to the fact that it gives privacy to the opening and settlement of payment channels on Lightning, it actually also makes the process of initializing a payment channel much easier and enables the L2 protocol, which I think is a combination that requires a whole new opcode, the SIGHASH no input. But by doing so, it enables a better key revocation, like a derivative key scheme in the payment channel. So essentially the process of backing up your channel and enforcing the forcing unilateral close of the channel becomes a much simpler and less costly process. Your update or commitment transactions that are ongoing, because you update the commitment transaction as the payment channel, you know, like I've got this payment channel open on Lightning, and every time I send money through it, we're initializing a new commitment transaction with a couple of handshakes back and forth. And with the current state, we have individual transactions. I have basically a half of a transaction on my side, and the other person has half a transaction, and then we both kind of have like an emergency clause with a time lock. But with L2, which I still haven't quite wrapped my head around, I actually did read the entire white paper, and I read it very slowly and repeated a couple of paragraphs, and I still didn't quite wrap my head around it. I'd actually planned to do an episode focusing on breaking it all down, and because I didn't get it, I didn't want to do that. I wanted to, I'm waiting for other people to release detailed information and better explanations or visualizations so that I know I understand it when I finally get to that piece. But it enables it so that both parties are actually holding the same backup rather than asymmetric backups. Like, rather than holding the left piece of the puzzle and they're holding the right piece of the puzzle, we're actually holding the exact same backup with a sequence of revocable keys. So the risk of a channel is that somebody will produce an old state of the transactions, or old state of the channel, and I will need the newer state to essentially reject it and revoke their key, and then I'll just sweep the entire channel. That's the adversarial circumstance in a basic Lightning channel. Whereas in L2, which would be enabled by these new mechanisms and that new opcode I was talking about, is the fascinating thing about that is that since you're holding the exact same final state, you can actually request, like, let's say you have a crash. Not only do you not have to save a backup of every single commitment revocation key, you only have to keep the very end one, the very final state, but you're not punished for accidentally sending a previous state. So let's say you have the second to last state and it backed up, you sent it to, you know, your watchtower, or let's say your mobile is your own personal watchtower or something. You sent the backup to your mobile, but when you created the very last state, something happened, connection got interrupted, and your hard drive failed, you know, whatever it is that causes it to break up. If you broadcast the second to last state, the other person will be like, oh, he might be cheating me, or will just notice that, you know, there's a double spend happening for a payment within the channel, and they broadcast the last state, but it no longer punishes you. It does not sweep the transaction, or it does not sweep the entire channel anymore. It just, the correct state overrides the incorrect state. So you're no longer punished for being ignorant or having a hard drive failure that causes you to lose your backup for the channel state. And it's exactly this stuff that enables that. So aside from everything, all the incredible stuff talked about in this, it adds privacy to the opening and closing of channels. It makes the writing of commitment transactions simpler, and it makes backups, it enables mechanisms to have backups and more fluid channels. This it just makes the overall operation of the Lightning Network much, it's less resource intensive, and it's just more fluid. At least as far as I've read, that's what I've gotten out of the information that I can gather from it. And it makes so many things align all at once. The whole two birds, one stone thing. I think this was just a really great way of putting it. I loved this article, even considering the fact that we've read a number of pieces on Schnorr already. It's always good to recover it. And I know there's new people pretty regularly. So, you know, maybe you haven't heard one on Schnorr. But this is just a really, really awesome one. And a huge thank you to Lucas Newsy for doing this article. Again, I really enjoy his stuff. I do a whole lot of reading, and this type of stuff in particular, like I'm just waiting. And I think it's even more meaningful in the context that soft forks, I believe, are going to get harder and harder to do on Bitcoin going forward. Like SegWit took a really long time to get in, and it was really it was really contentious with a small portion of the community. Even though it was completely backwards compatible, and even though it wasn't something that you actually had to use, I think it was more just they were pissed off that we did not hard fork and get a block size increase, and they basically just left the community. But because of that, I think the process of implementing future soft forks is going to lengthen, and we could very well end up in a situation like TCP/IP, where the work is done and we have IPv6 available, but 20 years later, it's still not implemented. You know, it still hasn't reached the quote unquote activation threshold. And it, like, I've always kind of had it in the back of my mind that even though I don't think any of the work at the base layer is going to stop, unless something very serious needs to be solved, and there's a really important challenge, essentially, that puts the base layer at risk, this next soft fork could possibly be the last soft fork that ever gets implemented on Bitcoin. I mean, that's not necessarily the case, but considering the difficulty and finesse that goes into making changes at the base layer, it's very possible that it is. It is certainly not out of the question that soft forks just become too hard to coordinate as this thing grows in size. You gotta remember, it's not simply that the community is risk averse and the developers are risk averse, and you know everybody wants to do years of due diligence before putting this on chain. It's also that there's way more money on the line as this thing grows, and there's way more people to organize. When Bitcoin is small, you can talk to 80% or 90% of the community much easier. But as this grows in size, as this becomes a trillion, multi-trillion dollar market, and it has so many players in so many different places under so many different jurisdictions and languages all over the world, we might not be able to get 95% of the hash power to do one thing. It just might not. The process may be so long as to be, and the Bitcoin network and ecosystem itself grows so fast that it just never reaches that point. And I have no doubt that it would be another thing of requiring 95% of the blocks to be signaling for Schnorr or whatever it is. Who knows? Maybe they'll implement it differently. I think there's been discussion of actually doing it as like a flag day or something. But anyway, this was just, I really love this article. And it's one of the most fascinating things to me going on in signatures and smart contracts in this space right now. And the fact that everybody seems on board with it, and that I've seen very little, if any, contention about it, just makes me crazy, crazy hopeful. And then, like with my article on Dandelion and a bright future of Bitcoin for Bitcoin privacy, as I said in that article, at times I have been a bit of a downer. I've been a bit of a pessimist in the past about whether or not privacy was literally just going to die away and we were going to have to deal with a world that no longer granted it. It is exactly these kinds of things that has renewed my optimism and made me think that, no, it is inevitable. Like, it is going to happen. It just is going to take a lot of work, a lot of coordination, but I think Bitcoin is going to be the one that does it. And I think it is one of the most important things for Bitcoin's survivability and staying power, that it cannot be used as a surveillance panopticon. Like, it cannot be that the data that keeps the system safe and censorship resistant, quote unquote, is not exactly the mechanism that is used to attack people who do things some corrupt government or institution doesn't want someone else to do. Because this whole fight is about freedom, independence, and sovereignty. And I think Bitcoin is going to be a huge piece of that puzzle. And I think Bitcoin is just going to revolutionize everything we think we know about that and how markets are built on top of that. So we will close that here. Hope you guys enjoyed that episode, loved that article. And do not forget to drop some crazy applause for Lucas Newsy, and head over to Digital Asset Research publication on Medium. There's a number, he has a lot of posts up there. I mean, you can just go to his Medium page too. I'll link to all this stuff, obviously. But there's a number of other things. There's, like he talked about, like diving into bulletproofs and ring signatures. You can actually find those articles and read them. A couple of them are really good. I haven't read all of them. But privacy is something that I read a lot, even though I don't want every episode on this show to be about privacy, but I could probably do that. I dig into that enough that it's really important to me. So with that, let's go ahead and close this. And don't forget to check him out. Don't forget to follow him on Twitter if you did not last time. And don't forget to follow me at The Crypto Economy. and check out cryptoeconomy.life, where I'm constantly making some updates. And that thing that I've been working on for most of the day is, if things go right, will be the conversation we're going to have on Monday. So don't miss that. Subscribe to the show. And again, the best thing you can do to help this show out is share it with other people you know in Bitcoin. So thank you so much for doing that. Go do it right now. It'll take you 10 seconds, and I will love you forever. All right, guys. Take it easy. And, oh, no, that's my final line. Oh, I did it too early. This has been the Crypto Economy Podcast. Until next time, have a good weekend, and take it easy, guys.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.